I'm subbing for another guard, so I've got to be at the pool in a few minutes. Why don't you come with me? It's a hot, beautiful day, and the water is going to feel wonderful.
I'd love to, Mom said. She pushed a damp strand of hair back from her forehead and laughed.
It wasn't hard to talk me into it, was it?
They turned toward me. I'll work on putting the books away. There aren't many left, I told them.
No, Dee Dee said firmly. Come with us. If you don't want to swim, no one's going to make you. But you can watch us having fun and work on your tan. If you don't have sunscreen, I'll lend you mine.
Mom didn't say a word. She just waited, but I could see the hope in her eyes.
I'll come and watch, I answered, although I wished I could do anything else but. I'd bring a book. I'd read. I wouldn't have to look at the pool if I didn't want to.
Try, Mom whispered when we arrived at the pool. To please her, I looked at the water and the people splashing and enjoying it, and did my best to tell myself I could enjoy it too. But I began to gasp with each breath, pressing my hands against the pain in my chest, remembering how my lungs had ached for air. I stumbled back to the safety and shade of a large oak tree, dropped to the grass with a shudder, and deliberately turned my back on the pool. Mom swam laps for a while down at the deep end, then walked to where I was lying on my stomach and dripped onto my arms and book as she wrapped her hair in a towel. As she sat beside me, I scrambled to my feet and asked, "Ready to go home?"
"I'd like to sun for a while, then have another swim," she answered. "Would you mind?"
"Mom, I came. I tried. Now I want to go home."
"I'll go with you."
"You don't need to. In fact, I wish you wouldn't. Stay and enjoy your swim. I can walk home in a few minutes."
"It's awfully hot, Sarah. Take the car," she said.
"No, you drive it back. Really, I'd rather walk."
I kissed her on top of her head, turned to wave to Dee Dee, and strode out of the pool area to the street. It took only a few minutes to walk home. As I unlocked and opened the front door, Dinky streaked past me, not even bothering to curl between my legs as she usually did.
"Dinky," I called, but she sat in the middle of the front flower bed, her back to me as if I didn't exist. Only the rhythmic twitching of the tip of her tail showed me that she was upset.
"Goofy cat," I told her. "What are you mad about now?"
I shut the front door against the heat and hurried to the kitchen for water. Houston in August was not the place to go walking. A tiny sound alerted me, and I tried to place it. What was it? A footstep? A board moving overhead? Or was it the click of a door closing? I waited, not breathing, listening intently, and began to sense that someone else was in the house. My first thought was Rosa, but it wasn't Rosa's presence I felt. Whoever was in this house was a living person, not a spirit, and he was just as aware of me as I was of him. I heard another light movement, almost too small to identify, but it was over my head. Someone was upstairs. Frantically, I tried to think of what to do. What if I bolted through the kitchen door to the backyard and circled the house and ran for help? But anger overrode my fear. Why should I let someone prowl through our house, helping himself to whatever he wanted? While I was going for help, he could get away. It wasn't fair. As quietly as I could, I tiptoed to the kitchen telephone and dialed 911. In a low voice, I gave the information to the police dispatcher. Okay. Now I could leave the house. I hung up and edged toward the back door, but the doorknob moved uselessly in my hand. The deadbolt was locked, and the key, which we left in the door, was gone. I heard a sound that seemed to come from the head of the stairs. He was coming closer. I'd be trapped in the kitchen, and it would take too long to try to unlock a window and tug it open. If the intruder was on the stairs, he could intercept me before I reached the front door. Maybe I could get to my parents' bathroom, lock myself inside, and climb out the window. The phone rang. It would be the police dispatcher calling back, but there was no time to answer. I broke into a run, not even trying to be silent, and heard him do the same. As his footsteps clattered down the stairway and across the entry hall, I gave up hope of reaching that back bathroom. I dashed down the little hallway to the nearby guest bathroom, flung myself inside, slammed the door behind me, and locked it. I leaned against the wall for support and waited in the darkness, not daring to turn on the light. It was easier to hear each separate sound in the dark. Unfortunately, there was no window in this bathroom, no way I could escape. I could see light under the door where the sunlight reflected on the tiles. The pattern was broken as someone stepped in front of the door and stood there. What was he going to do? The light pattern shifted as he stepped away from the door. I let out a long swoosh of air, suddenly aware that I hadn't been breathing. I knew what I'd do in his place. I'd go to the kitchen and get a small screwdriver or a skewer, something long and thin, to put inside the hole in the center of the doorknob and jiggle the tumbler so the lock would open. I'd used that safety hole more than once when I was babysitting little children who could lock bathroom doors but couldn't open them. If that was what he had in mind, then my only chance was to get out of here before he came back. My hand was so slippery with sweat that it slipped against the knob. I hesitated, too fearful to move. What if he was just outside the door, waiting? I thought of Dinky, silently poised to pounce on the birds that flew to our front lawn. Was the person on the other side of the door also waiting, crouched and ready to spring if I should open this door? The sound of a footstep, and he was back. Under the door, the light was once more broken by the shadow from his shoes. I pressed back against the wall, well aware that I had nothing with which to defend myself. I thought I heard the doorknob move, but I heard something else. A police siren, and it was coming closer. There was a hiss as whoever was outside the door took a sharp breath. He had to have heard the siren. His footsteps left the hallway, moving silently but quickly. The siren was shrill as the police car swung into our driveway. Heedlessly, I threw open the bathroom door and ran into the entry hall just as an officer knocked loudly on the front door. Unable to stop shaking or to keep my teeth from chattering, I led the two police officers into the house and tried to explain what had happened. It was hard to tell them apart. They were both of medium height with medium brown hair and probably in their mid-30s. They told me their names, but I was so scared I couldn't remember them. One searched upstairs, one down. They examined the front and back doors and some of the downstairs windows.
"There's no sign of an intruder in the house and no sign of forced entry," one of them said. "Have you found anything missing?"
Embarrassed because I hadn't thought to look, I took a quick tour of the house. Everything seemed to be in place. Mom's shoulder bag was lying on her bed, and the wallet, with money inside, was in place. I checked Mom's jewelry box. She didn't have much of the real stuff, just her watch and a couple of rings. But they hadn't been touched. Upstairs was the same. Tiny dust motes drifted through the bands of sunlight that spilled from my window onto the carpet. Dinky, who had strolled in when I'd opened the door to the officers, paraded past me, jumped to the bed, and settled, her eyes accusing me of allowing her peace to be disturbed. "What do you know about this, Dinky?" I asked her, but her only answer was to squeeze her eyes shut slowly and pretend I wasn't there.
"Did you actually see someone in the house?" the first officer asked me as I rejoined them downstairs.
"No, I just heard someone."
"Houses pop and creak with temperature changes. Maybe you heard the air conditioner start up."
"No, I heard footsteps. He was standing outside the bathroom door."
"Did he try to open the door?"
I don't know."
"Did you see the doorknob move?"
"Not exactly. I didn't turn on the light."
They gave each other a patient look, and I felt my cheeks burn as my face reddened.
I didn't imagine it. Someone was here.
One of the officers gave me his business card and said, "If you have any more trouble, just call us."
"You don't believe me." The other wiped the sweat from his forehead with the back of one hand and replaced his hat.
"No sign of forced entry," he said. "And nothing missing, so far as you can tell. If it were someone burglarizing the house, he probably would have taken your mother's watch and rings. He'd definitely have taken the cash, and maybe the credit cards."
"I guess," I answered. But another thought hit me. Unless he didn't come here to steal anything. The officer with his hand on the doorknob paused and turned to look at me.
"Have you had any strange phone calls? Anyone following you? Any reason to think you might be a target?"
"No."
The other officer nodded toward the card in my hand. It was obvious he was getting impatient. "Call us if you need us," he said.
"Thank you," I mumbled as they left the house. I knew they didn't believe me. "Why was someone in this house?" I asked aloud. "Why? Why? Why?" The next thought startled me.
"Who?"
I didn't have the answer.
Chapter 10. Mom and the police car passed each other as she drove into our street. I waited outside while she parked the car. I knew there'd be questions.
"It looked to me as though that police car came out of our driveway," Mom said before I had a chance to tell her a thing.
Her suit was almost dry under the shirt she was wearing as a cover-up, and her towel was draped around her neck.
"It did," I said. "I called the police."
Mom stopped in mid-step and stared at me.
"Why? What happened?"
"Come on inside. I'll tell you all about it." She followed me into the house and back to the kitchen, asking,
"Was someone trying to break in?"
A sudden thought struck her, and she grabbed my shoulders, searching my face.
"Sarah, you're all right, aren't you?"
"Mom," I had to shout to get her to pay attention.
"Stop asking so many questions. Just listen to me."
"Tell me first about you," she demanded.
"I'm fine. No problems."
"Then what?"
"Sit down, Mom, and give me a chance."
I practically pushed her into the nearest kitchen chair and sat beside her. When I came home, I went straight to the kitchen for a drink of water. While I was in the kitchen, I thought I heard someone moving around upstairs, so I called the police.
"Did they catch him? Oh my gosh!"
Her right hand clasped her left wrist.
"My watch! It was right there on the nightstand! And my handbag! The credit cards!"
She was half out of her chair. "Whoever it was didn't take anything," I assured her. She looked puzzled and sat down again.
"Nothing? Who was it? Did you see him?"
"No." I took a deep breath that ended in a sigh. "Mom, I know I heard someone run down the stairs. I locked myself in the guest bathroom, so I didn't see him, but I heard him."
"Why didn't you try to get away from him by running out the back door?" Mom asked.
"That would have been quicker and safer."
"Because the deadbolt was locked and the key wasn't in the door."
We both looked at the door at the same time.
"There it is," Mom said. "On the floor, right under the lock."
"It wasn't there then. I would have seen it. That's why I ran to the bathroom. I heard him run down the stairs. He came down the hall toward the bathroom. I could even see his shadow when he stood in front of the door."
Mom's eyes were wide, and her mouth opened. "But,
please don't interrupt. Let me tell you, I don't know if he was going to try to unlock the bathroom door or not. When he heard the police siren, he left."
"The police must have seen him."
"They didn't. They searched upstairs and downstairs and didn't find any sign of forced entry. And nothing was missing."
Bitterly, I added, "They practically said they thought I imagined the whole thing."
Mom looked troubled. She reached over and took my hand.
"Is there any chance that you could have, Sarah? The key is there."
"No," I insisted. Her glance was searching.
"Sarah, you've never explained what frightened you when you first set foot in this house. Could what happened here today be tied in with that?"
She took a deep breath, and I could see the fear in her eyes. "Does this all have anything to do with that spirit you once imagined was with you?" "No."
"Well, then," Mom said brightly, as though she were doing her best to support me, "I'll get out of this bathing suit and we'll take another look around."
In spite of her words, I could see the doubt in her eyes, and it hurt. In less than 5 minutes, she returned, her hair still damp and uncombed.
"I'll take the downstairs, you take the upstairs," she said, and disappeared into the dining room, where I knew she'd count the silver. I automatically went to my own room first. Nothing had been disturbed, including a handful of change I'd left on top of the chest. One by one, I repeated the opening and checking of each drawer, starting at the top. Nothing had been touched. But as I tried to close the bottom drawer, it seemed to stick, resisting my efforts. It was as though someone were tugging it out as I was trying to push it in. I suddenly stopped, and the drawer wobbled, jumping back an inch.
"Why are you doing—"
I didn't finish the question because I suddenly knew the answer. I dropped to my knees and shoved both hands into the folded clothes, my fingers frantically groping for Rosa's packet. It was no longer in the drawer. It was gone. So angry that tears burned my eyes, I sat back on my heels. Whoever was in this house had stolen it. Who would do such a thing? My first thought was Tony, but I didn't know why it would have been Tony. No, it couldn't have been. He had even warned me to hide the packet. Dee Dee knew about it. She'd seen Rose's things, even read the letter. But there was no way she could have left her lifeguard job to break into our house. But Dee Dee couldn't keep a secret. Tony had been concerned about this, and now I was too. I knew that she'd told Lupita about Rose's things, and I bet she told Eric. Could Eric have been the thief? I closed the drawer, which offered no resistance now, and walked into the short hallway that led to both bedrooms. As I stood there, trying to sort out my thoughts, I stared ahead into the spare bedroom, watching a hot breeze ruffle the leaves of the tree outside the window. The curtain was caught in the sash. My skin prickled as I realized what I was seeing. No one had opened this window, not with the air conditioning on. Then how did the curtain get caught? I rushed to the window and opened it, pulling the curtain aside. Below the window was a short ledge, and nearly touching the ledge was a long, thick branch of the tree that was centered in the narrow courtyard garden between this part of the front of the house and the garage. I closed the window and tried to lock it, but the lock on top of the sash was loose and spun around. The metal piece into which it would have fastened was not on the sash. The minute Dad came home, I'd ask him to repair the lock. Until then, frantically, I looked around the room, trying to find something to wedge against the lower sash so the window wouldn't open, but I didn't see anything that would hold it. My thoughts ran into and over each other so rapidly it was hard to keep up. This had been Adam's room. His father must have known the lock was broken. Maybe Adam had broken it on purpose. For how many years had Adam sneaked in and out of this window? Mr. Holt lied to me about the years in which Rosa had worked for them. Had he told Adam what I'd found? Had Adam come back to steal the packet? Adam, the murderer, had he been the one I'd heard in the house? But Eric had said that Adam went to California to live with his mother. If it wasn't Adam, it had to be Eric. I ran toward the telephone in my room, sprawling across the bed. I flipped through the phone book with numb fingers until I found Eric's number, then dialed it.
"Hello,"
he said. I stared at the phone for a moment, unable to answer.
"Hello,"
Eric said again.
"Who's there?"
It's me, Sarah.
"Sarah who?"
he asked in a mocking tone. I put all my fury and strength behind my words.
"Eric, where is Adam Holt?"
He hesitated for only a moment.
"I told you, he's living in California with his mother."
He slipped into the mocking tone again.
Oh, I see. You want the name of the town. Forgot it, did you? Well, it's Cedar Creek.
Patiently, he spelled.
C-E-D-A-R,
I interrupted. It's a big joke to you, isn't it?
Big joke? I wouldn't know. I've never been there.
Eric, you know what I mean. Why are you treating me like this? His voice softened just a little.
You haven't got much sense of humor, have you, Sarah?
Not when it comes to someone breaking into our house and scaring me to death.
You don't sound dead. You sound extremely alive and healthy.
I took a deep breath and tried to keep from screaming at him. Eric, are you lying to me?
Lying? About what?
Cut it out. Are you lying about Adam being in California?
Of course not.
He said so smoothly it was as though he were pretending to lie. I'm not going to get a straight answer out of you, am I?
Very few people do.
You're covering up for Adam Holt, aren't you? Why are you on his side? He bit his words off angrily.
Why shouldn't I be? Adam wasn't convicted. That means he's free. So what's he supposed to do for the rest of his life? Live somewhere he doesn't want to live? Like an outcast?
I tried to hold back a sob, but I couldn't.
Did you break into our house?
I asked him.
Why should I do a thing like that?
The police were here. Didn't you see them?
No. I just got home. What happened?
He sounded more curious than concerned. I rubbed furiously at my eyes with the back of one fist. Someone was in the house when I came back from the pool.
That's terrible. Did he steal anything?
There was a false note in his voice as though he were covering up. Covering what? I was determined to find out. Nothing was stolen, I said. I was afraid he was after Rose's things, but fortunately he didn't find them.
But...
His surprise slipped out before he could check it. My trick had worked. Eric knew about Rose's possessions, and he knew who'd come after them. Was it Adam? Or Eric?
You're no help. Thanks for nothing,
I snapped at him, and hung up before he could say another word. One more thing to look up in the telephone book. The area code for Cedar Creek, California. Directory assistance gave me a telephone number for Mrs. Martin Holt. She answered on the third ring, and I was almost too nervous to talk. My voice came out in a squeak as I asked, "May I please speak to Adam?" I heard her suck in her breath. There was a long pause, and her voice was suspicious when she asked,
"Who is this?"
"My name is Sarah."
"Do you have a last name, Sarah?"
"I'm sorry, ma'am. Sarah Darnell." I tried to mumble the last word, hoping she wouldn't hear it clearly and connect it with the buyers of her Houston house.
"Why do you want to talk to Adam?"
she persisted.
"Are you another reporter?"
"Oh, no." Quickly, I tried to reassure her. "I'm only 16. I'm in high school." I had thought she'd be reassured, but the suspicion was still in her voice as she answered,
"Where are you calling from?"
"I didn't mean to bother you," I said. "Please, could I talk to Adam?" Her voice was sharp.
"I'm sorry. Adam can't talk to you right now."
"Will he be back soon?"
"How should I know? I don't keep track of his hours," she snapped. "You can leave your number, but I can't guarantee if he'll return your call. Just don't keep calling and pestering me. Understand?"
"I understand," I said, and hung up. I was sure now that Adam didn't live with his mother. Slowly, I walked down the stairs and sat on the bottom step, trying to sort out my thoughts. As I glanced at the window by the door, I remembered how frightened I had been when I'd seen Dee Dee peering through it.
"Anybody who comes to the door can see right inside the hall. It would be hard not to,"
Dee Dee had said. So when Darlene Garland had come to the door with her pizza delivery, what had she seen? Suppose that Adam Holt hadn't killed her because she resisted him, as he had claimed. Suppose he had killed her because she had witnessed something he hadn't wanted anyone to see. Rosa's murder? It seemed like a wild idea, but I became excited as it began to fit. I remembered that the woman who lived across the street from the Holt said she had heard screaming, but had placed it earlier than the delivery girl's arrival. Had she heard Rosa screaming and not Darlene? Adam's parents hadn't called the police and had been in the house for at least 20 minutes before the police contacted them. Why? Had they suspected that Rosa had been murdered and tried to get rid of any trace of the woman? That would account for the time. If no one knew of Rosa's presence, if she had come alone to the United States and had no family who knew her whereabouts, who would miss her? Who would know that she was gone? I didn't have all the facts I needed, but I thought I knew where I could get them. In the morning, I borrowed the car from Mom, telling her only that I needed to go downtown again. It was my dumb good luck that when I reached the police administration building on Reisner and asked to speak to the detective in charge of the Adam Holt case, he was there and agreed to talk with me. His name was Mark Hardison. He was stocky and slightly balding, and his face looked like weathered leather.
"Sit down," Sergeant Hardison said, pointing to the chair across from his desk. "What can I do for you?"
I told him that we lived in Adam Holt's house. He raised one eyebrow, and I wondered if he felt the way we did about living in a house where a murder had taken place. "I need to ask you some questions," I said. "I've read all the newspaper accounts about Darlene Garland's murder, and..."
"Why are you dwelling on the murder?" he asked. "Wouldn't it be a lot healthier to try to forget about it?"
"No," I insisted, "because I think..." I didn't want to tell him yet, and obviously I couldn't tell him everything. "Please, let me ask you a couple of questions, and then I'll explain." He nodded briefly, so I asked, "When Adam Holt was arrested, was he cut? Was he bleeding?"
"Aside from a couple of scratches made by fingernails, he wasn't hurt."
"But at the trial, the medical examiner said they had found two blood types."
"That's right."
"How much blood of each type?" He frowned.
"We didn't ask that question. Offhand, it didn't seem relevant."
"You tested Adam's blood?"
"Of course. He's type A, the same as one of the samples found by the medical examiner."
"How do you know it was his blood exactly? A lot of people are type A."
"It was tested for type only, as far as I know."
"Isn't there any way to test blood to make absolutely sure it came from a particular person?"
"There is now. There's a new way to match blood to a specific person through DNA, but we didn't have the information or equipment to take the tests at that time."
"Do you have the equipment now?"
"Not here in Houston. We can send samples to a lab in New York State."
"Could a test still be made from the sample you have?" He leaned back in his chair and smiled.
"The people who invented the process claim it could even be done on a mummy."
"On a mummy?" "I know I'm taking a lot of your time," I apologized, "but I'd really like to know what DNA is and how it works."
"No problem,"
he said.
"It's not hard to explain. DNA, deoxyribonucleic acid, is in each cell of our bodies and is unlike that of everyone else's, so it's as accurate as a fingerprint. If a body's cells are badly decomposed, DNA can even be taken from bones or the pulp in teeth."
"That blood sample from the house may have been Adam's type, but I'm sure that it wasn't his blood."
"Just what are you getting at?"
"I think the blood came from a woman named Rosa Louise." He sat upright, and his eyes drilled into mine as he said,
"Well, that name never came up. Who is she?"
I told him about the packet belonging to Rosa, and that it had been stolen from the house. I explained who I thought Rosa was. "I know that everything wasn't in the newspaper stories, and that's why I came to you, to get some answers. There are too many things that don't add up. For instance, when I read the newspaper accounts of Darlene Garland's murder, it didn't make sense to me that Adam would have met her at the door with a knife and tried to force her inside. She was at the wrong address. He hadn't been expecting her. It wasn't as though he'd been lying in wait for her. But she would have seen him through the window when she rang the doorbell. She would have seen what was taking place in the entry hall.
Seen what?
He leaned forward, listening intently. I think Darlene was an eyewitness to another murder. I think that she saw Adam kill Rosa Louise. There, I'd said it. I let out a deep breath.
I don't know where you got your information, but I think you're mistaken about this Rosa person. There was no sign that anyone besides the Holtz was living in that house.
What were the parents doing during the 20 minutes they were home before the police arrived? They had time to get rid of any evidence that Rosa had existed.
We have no proof of that.
We have proof that Rosa had lived there. The calendar. I stopped. Oh, no. I forgot it was stolen.
We have only your word that those things exist.
My friend next door saw them, too. She translated the letter.
Did you show these things to your parents?
No, I meant to. That is, I was going to show them after I added up all the facts and put them together.
Do you watch a lot of television?
He asked.
Private eye shows, cops and robbers stuff.
I'm not making this up, I said. Please take what I say seriously. There are other things that fit in. The woman who lived next door to the Holtz heard the screams earlier than the time Darlene would have arrived at the Holtz house. Those must have been Rosa's screams.
At the trial, the defense attorney tore apart the neighbor's testimony without any trouble. She wasn't a credible witness. The time she estimated meant nothing.
He shook his head.
The district attorney would like nothing better than to reopen the Holt case, believe me. But there'd be no way to make a strong enough case without someone who could place Adam Holt at the scene of the crime.
Couldn't you question Martin Holt about Rosa? I know he lied to me about the dates she worked for them.
What makes you think he wouldn't lie to me, too?
Discouraged and even a little angry, I slumped in my chair as Sergeant Hardison continued.
You have nothing to go on but guesswork concerning this Rosa Louise. I have a clear recollection of the maid's room in that house. There was no bedding on the bed and nothing in the dresser drawers. The room was clean with no sign that anyone had occupied it for years. We had no reason to doubt the Holtz on that one.
He stood, ending the conversation, so I had to stand too.
I'm sorry, he said. They may have had an illegal alien working for them close to that time, but she could have left and gone back to Mexico months before the murder took place. You have some interesting ideas about what might have happened, but all you're doing is guessing. There's nothing tangible to go on.
I was halfway to the door of the homicide room when I remembered another question. What about fingerprints? I asked. Darlene Garland was stabbed. Weren't Adam's fingerprints on the knife enough to help convict him?
They would have been a big help, he said. Unfortunately, the murder weapon was never found.
Chapter 11. When I got home, I found a note on the hall table from Mom. She'd walked to the pool and planned to be back by 1:30 or so. I'd just missed her. I could join her, but I didn't want to. Maybe I'd drive down to pick her up. I didn't feel like eating lunch. I was tired and discouraged. I sat in Dad's reclining chair and tilted it back, closing my eyes. There was a plop as Dinky leapt into my lap. I stroked her head, scratching around her ears and chin, but her purr stopped suddenly, and I felt her hair rise and bristle. What is it, Dinky? My hand dropped as Dinky shot from my lap with a guttural cry and streaked from the room. My mind seemed alert, but my body wouldn't react. I tried to open my eyes, but they were too heavy. What was going on? Gradually, the room shifted and the atmosphere changed. The feel of the air, the way it smelled, even the furniture under me, It was all different.
Sara, venga acá, Sara.
I remember the words because a teacher had used them often. Come here.
Venga acá.
The voice that called to me from the entry hall was heavy with tears. Please, no, I cried out. Terror spread from a cold lump inside my chest, shivering along my arms and down to my fingertips. My eyes opened to another room, another time. Reluctantly, I rose from my chair and walked, one slow step after the other, as though I were an automaton, until I could see into the entry hall. I stopped, clinging to the door frame for support, trembling so hard that I was unable to go any farther. From where I was standing, I could see across the entry hall to the front door and the window next to it. Once again, the white marble tiles were yellowed with sunlight, and the room was decorated as it had been before, except that this time the crystal vase of sweet peas was upright. Suddenly, a scream tore the air, and I clapped my hands over my ears. Before me, I saw Rosa being dragged across the floor. Her blouse had been ripped off. Her skirt was torn. She was screaming, struggling against a tall, blonde boy who bent over her, his right hand clutching a kitchen knife. As he raised it high, I ducked my head and screamed too, screamed over and over and over, unable to stop. Suddenly, he yelled in surprise. I heard him run to the front door and throw it open. There were sounds of a scuffle, as though people were fighting, and through it all, a woman's shouts for help. I couldn't look, and I couldn't stop screaming. The room swirled. I lost my balance and fell to the floor, crying and sobbing. I'd been shown the horror of what happened, and I hadn't wanted to see it. Rosa's terrified voice shouted in my mind, "Peligro! Peligro!" "Leave me alone," I begged, gasping with shock as someone grabbed my shoulders and jerked me up from the floor. I opened my eyes to look into Tony's face.
"Stop screaming," he shouted at me.
"Peligro!" "The murders," I cried, half out of my mind. "There was blood, blood everywhere. Rosa's blood and Darlene's blood."
"Sara, stop it. What are you talking about?"
Tony's face was pale and shocked. I clutched his arms and hung on tightly. "Tony, I saw it. I saw him, Adam, attacking Rosa. It was just as I thought. Someone came. Darlene. Yes, it had to be Darlene. She could see through the window. Adam had to stop her from telling what she had seen."
"You saw this?" he whispered.
He dragged me to my feet. His hands were rough, and his eyes were wide with fear.
"How could you see all this? Tell me. You weren't there when it happened."
"Rosa," I tried to tell him. "She asked for my help. She wanted me to see." I burst into tears and covered my face with my hands. Tony stepped back from me. I could hear a frightened hiss of air between his teeth. I felt arms wrapped around me, and I heard Mom ask, "What's going on here? What's the matter with Sara?"
"It's not my fault."
Fear shook Tony's voice as he faced Mom.
"I came and found her like this. She says she saw something."
I held tight to Mom. "I saw the murders," I said, sobbing.
"Murders?"
Mom sounded scared too.
"Who are you?"
she demanded of Tony. "What are you doing here?"
"I'm Tony, Anthony Harris," he said. "I came by to see Sara, that's all. She was like this when I got here."
"Tony," Mom murmured as she recognized the name.
"Of course, Sarah's told us about you." I'll clear out," Tony said. "I'll get out of your way."
"No," Mom told him. "Please sit down and wait for us, Tony. I want to talk to both you and Sara." Mom took charge, and I was glad to let her. She washed my face, brought me two aspirins and a glass of water, and settled me in the big reclining chair in the den. Tony was sitting hunched forward, his hands clasped together, his forearms resting on his knees. "I'm sorry, Tony," I began. But he didn't look up or answer. He just shook his head. It wasn't supposed to be like this. I felt more miserable than ever. As Mom sat down, she turned to me and said, "I want to know everything that happened here. You first, Sarah. Start at the very beginning." What difference did it make now? There was no point in hiding it any longer. I started with the day we came to this house and told Mom and Tony everything I'd heard and seen, except for my conversation with the detective. I didn't know why. Maybe because he had discouraged me and I felt a little embarrassed about having gone to talk to him. By the time I'd finished describing the apparition, I was exhausted. I wished I could curl up and go to sleep, but Mom turned to Tony. "I'd like to hear whatever you have to say about it, Tony." He was so pale that the blue of his eyes stood out more sharply than ever, and the skin was stretched tightly over his knuckles as he gripped the arms of his chair.
I knew about the packet of Rose's things," he said. "Sarah told me about it, and I warned her to hide it."
"Why?" Mom asked, interrupting.
"I'm not sure. I didn't know what it meant, but I was afraid it could be damaging to Adam."
"In what way?" He shook his head.
"I don't know. Adam's gone through enough, and I didn't want him disturbed by something that was useless and unimportant. I hoped that Sarah would keep the whole thing quiet."
"I don't think the calendar was unimportant," I insisted. "It showed that Rosa was here up to the time the murder took place."
"Are you sure what year was on that calendar?" Tony asked.
"Yes, I'm sure."
"Why didn't you show it to me?" Mom asked. "You didn't even tell me about it."
"I was going to, when I knew what it meant." My excuse seemed weak. I looked at Tony. "Tell me, if you know, is Eric the one who stole the packet?"
"Why ask me?" Tony answered. "You'll have to ask Eric that one."
Mom's eyebrows dipped into a frown. "Was there a Rosa who worked here, Tony?"
"As I told Sarah, I think I remember a Rosa, but I don't remember when she worked here," he said.
Mom made a little puzzled sound. "Then Rosa isn't just a figment of Sarah's imagination, like..." She stopped.
"This is different, Mom," I protested. "Besides, the other presence wasn't in my imagination either."
Tony's gaze was filled with suspicion, and his voice was so low I could barely hear it.
"Do you talk to spirits? Are you some kind of a witch?"
"No," I shouted. "Rosa called on me for help, and I promised to help her. I didn't know what it would mean. After I nearly died..." I turned to Mom, holding out my hands in despair.
"Please, Mom, I can't talk about it. You tell him."
Mom explained to Tony about the aftermath of my near-death experience. When she finished, she came to me and gently rested a hand on my forehead, stroking back my hair. "There's no question about it. I'm going to call Dr. Clark and ask him to recommend someone here in Houston who can help you. This hallucinating is very dangerous, Sarah, and we're going to get help immediately."
I knew I wasn't hallucinating, but I was too tired to argue about it, and the idea of turning my problems over to someone else was very appealing at the moment.
"Ayúdame." Rosa's plea for help lingered.
I could picture the slender young woman with the sorrowful eyes. With an ache, I remembered my promise. Mom held out a hand to Tony, who stood and shook hers solemnly.
"I'm sorry we had to meet during such frightening circumstances," Mom told him. "Thank you for trying to help Sarah."
Obviously, she was still trying to sort out the whole thing, so she turned before she reached the door to the kitchen.
"When you arrived at our house, Sarah was in the grips of this hallucination," she said. "Is that right?"
"Yes," Tony answered.
"Then how did you get in?"
He paused for only a second.
"I could see Sarah huddled on the floor. I tried the door, and fortunately it was unlocked, so I was able to get inside.
The door was locked when I came home, Mom said. I had to use my key to open it.
Tony's glance didn't waver. Force of habit, I guess. I must have automatically turned the deadbolt as I shut the door.
Of course. Mom nodded and managed to come up with a shaky smile. I hope you understand that I'm just trying to get the whole picture. I do appreciate your help, Tony.
I understand, he said, and Mom left the room. While they were talking, I was trying hard to remember. I'd come home, unlocked the door, and entered the house. Hadn't I locked the door behind me? I was sure I had. Force of habit, as Tony said. Locking the door was just something I automatically did without thinking. Is that why I couldn't remember having done it? But maybe I hadn't locked it. Tony must have been right about the door being unlocked. He'd gotten inside, hadn't he? There was another possibility. In my mind, I saw the window upstairs in the guest bedroom. Tony knew Adam. Did he know about the broken lock on Adam's bedroom window? Dad planned to buy the hardware for the lock today and fix it tonight. Tony could have entered through the window. Tony walked over to stand before me, so I struggled to get to my feet. "Don't get up, Sarah," he protested, but I was already standing. "I'll go now. You don't need me here."
"I don't blame you for wanting to go," I mumbled. "I'm sorry about what happened. I'm sorry because..." I felt myself blushing, and I couldn't finish the sentence. After that awful scene he'd witnessed, I knew I'd never see Tony again. Strange Sarah. Weird Sarah. I wished I could hide. But Tony surprised me by taking my chin and giving me a light kiss on the lips. His eyes were so blue, so wonderfully blue, that they hypnotized me. I didn't want to look away from them.
"I'm only going so that you can rest," he said. "I'll be back."
"You asked if I was a witch," I whispered.
"Oh, Sarah." He wrapped me tightly in his arms, and I could hear the beat of his heart. "I don't know what I said. We were all so scared. Forget it. Forget everything I said, will you?"
"Yes."
I was more than content to forget and stay close in his arms, but he stepped away. "I'll call you soon," he said. "That's a promise." Mom came back, walked Tony to the door, and I heard only the low murmur of their voices. When she returned, she said, "I was able to talk to Dr. Clark immediately. He gave me the name of a Houston therapist and said the man has a very good reputation."
"Did you tell Dr. Clark about Rosa? About the murders?"
"No," she said. "I just told him you were having some frightening hallucinations."
"Mom, they're not..."
She interrupted nervously. "The doctor you'll be seeing is named Dr. Arnold Fulton. One of his patients had just canceled an appointment for 10 tomorrow morning, and we got the time. Wasn't that fortunate?"
"Mom," I told her, "please don't be afraid."
"Afraid? Sweetheart, I'm terrified. I don't know why this is happening to you, and I want it to stop."
"Maybe it would stop if I found out what Rosa wants."
Mom hugged me.
"Sarah, don't do this. You're hurting yourself, and that hurts your father and me. Whatever happened in this house is over and done with. Please believe that."
I returned her hug, saying,
"I don't want to hurt you, Mom."
"I know you don't, Sarah. I put that badly," she said, tears in her eyes, too. She tried to smile. "Why don't you go upstairs and take a nap?"
"I am awfully tired," I said. I could feel her eyes on me as I walked slowly up the stairs. The first thing I did was check the window in the guest bedroom. It was closed, so it told me nothing. Had it been opened? I took a wooden coat hanger out of the closet and jammed it between the sash and the top of the window. I wished I'd thought of that before. It wasn't a tight fit, but I thought it would hold until Dad fixed the lock. As I walked into my own bedroom, a word kept returning, flicking in and out of my mind like a persistent little gnat. Peligro. I tried to wave it away, but I couldn't ignore it. Peligro, the woman had called. What did it mean? I thumbed through the vocabulary list at the back of my Spanish-English phrasebook and found the word quickly. Peligro. Danger. I had seen a repeat, as though it were a film, of the murders. Afterward, I had lain on the floor sobbing, screaming, trying to escape the horror of what I had seen and heard. A woman had cried out, Peligro! Danger! But the murders had already happened. The scene was over, and Tony was there to help me. It didn't fit. The warning was in the wrong place. I didn't want to think about it any longer. My head hurt, and I was desperate for sleep. I flung back the blanket and sheet, kicked off my shoes, and climbed into bed, rolling myself into a tight ball. Mercifully, within seconds, I felt myself dropping into sleep. Dr. Arnold Fulton matched his office. He was middle-aged and slender, with a head of hair as full as his thick brown beard. His furniture was expensive but nondescript, and it was all in browns and greens and beiges. It was designed to be restful. Dr. Fulton was beige and brown and restful, too. He moved slowly, with precision, and his voice was soft. He asked Mom to wait in his parlor while he heard my story. I began with the drowning and went right through to the horror of yesterday's apparition. He sat motionless, his greenish-gray eyes on mine, and, except for an occasional blink, he didn't move through the whole recital. When I finished, I waited for him to speak. I waited so long that it made me uncomfortable. "Aren't you going to say something?" I finally asked. "You've related a remarkable tale. I need time to assimilate it." "Mom and Dad are worried about me. They want to help me, which is why I'm here. But I want to be honest with you. I promised Rosa I would help her, and I'm going to do it." "How can you help Rosa?" he asked. I don't know yet," I said. "I think she'll let me know." I took a deep breath to hide my embarrassment. "Look, I know how all this sounds, but I believe in Rosa. I have to." "Do you believe that your house is haunted?" The question startled me. "Haunted? No, I hadn't thought. Why did you ask that?" "You've related a story of a ghostly voice, noises, and apparitions." I felt myself blush. "I didn't mean it to sound like that. I was talking about a person, Rosa." "Who you believe is haunting you?" "You make it seem like a horror movie." He toyed with a pencil, spinning it up and down between his thumb and finger, and was silent for a few long minutes. Finally, he said, "Houses are not haunted." I interrupted angrily. "I just told you that I..." In turn, he spoke before I could finish my sentence. "Houses are not haunted, Sarah. People are, and not by either preternatural or supernatural beings, but by their own internal fears." "Rosa Luis is very real. I didn't know about her before we moved into that house. And don't forget the packet. It's real." "Very well. We'll accept the fact that the packet exists. Can you see that the packet could, in itself, have been the stimulus for the scene that took place in your mind?"
"It could, I guess, but it wasn't."
"Sarah, would you describe yourself as a creative, imaginative person?"
"Yes, but..."
"Then the house and the occurrence could have been the vehicles that allowed you to manifest your own fears. Do you see what I'm getting at?"
"You mean my fear of the water? My fear of dying?"
"It's possible."
"But why would I hear someone calling for help?"
"Think about it." It doesn't take long to see what he's getting at. "Do you mean that I'm the one calling for help?"
Dr. Fulton didn't answer. He just waited, watching me.
So I'm calling for help in solving my own problem.
Okay, but what does that have to do with a murder?
Do you still dream about drowning?
I was surprised.
Why, no, I guess not.
When did the dreams of drowning stop?
I had to think for a minute.
About the time we moved here?
Do you think your fears have taken on a new form?
I don't think so. When I dreamed about Rosa, it was very different. Rosa was a real person, don't you see?
He stood and said, Sarah, I'd like to help you work through this problem. I'll talk to your mother now and set up the next appointment. Is this agreeable to you?
Yes, I answered, simply because I didn't know what else to say. Dr. Fulton talked to Mom, and she seemed less frantic and more relaxed as we left his office and began the drive home.
He seemed like a nice, sympathetic person, Mom said.
He thinks it's all in my imagination.
Mom took her eyes off the road for only a second to glance at me sharply.
He didn't say that.
But he thinks it. I can tell, I said.
Mom, I didn't imagine Rosa and what I saw any more than I imagined the presence that used to follow me after I nearly drowned.
Oh, sweetheart, Mom said quickly. I like Dr. Fulton, and I know he'll be able to help you.
Mom seemed so hopeful, I didn't want to discourage her.
I guess that means I'd better try to conquer my fear of the water, I said.
Okay, I'll do my best.
Good for you, Sarah. Mom beamed and reached over to pat my knee. Sooner or later, I was going to have to swim again. But I could still feel the dark water smothering me, holding me, while my heart pounded against my ears and my lungs exploded with pain. I don't care what they believe, I thought. My fear of drowning didn't create Rosa. She's real, and she needs my help.
Chapter 12. Tony telephoned soon after we arrived home.
What did the therapist tell you? He asked.
I attempted to make light of it.
He thinks it's just my imagination working overtime.
I expected Tony to laugh or kid about it, but he didn't. He was serious when he asked,
What did he say when you told him about Rosa?
He didn't seem to think Rosa was important. He was more interested in what he thinks is my overact